This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're going to be talking about financial abuse of the elderly. We're going to be talking about why older persons are more susceptible to financial abuse. We'll be talking about some of the things that are being done by people who are concerned about this. We're going to talk about remedies that are available to people. And I think hopefully you'll get something out of this in terms of if you are an older person or someone close to you is an older person. My guests are Prescott Cole, Senior Staff Attorney with California Advocates for Nursing Home Reform. Prescott this year won the Clay Award for Elder Law. I'll ask him to be modest and tell us a little bit about it in a few minutes.
It was a thrill.
And it will be a thrill for all of us. Dr. Erica Falk is here. She's Director of Geriatric Assessment and Psychological Services at the Institute on Aging in San Francisco. She is a licensed clinical psychologist with specialized training in geropsychology. Thank you very much. And she also is the director of the San Francisco Elder Abuse Forensic Center, which is a public-private partnership with San Francisco's Police Department, District Attorney's Office, and Adult Protective Services. Our third guest is Stephen Reese. He's a financial elder abuse attorney in San Francisco. Most of his practice relates to that. He's also been involved for a number of years with the legislature, where he has been helping to draft financial abuse of elder laws. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California. Additional funding is provided by the Family Law Section of the State Bar, the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Welcome to the program. Thank you very much for being here. Erica, if you don't mind, I'd appreciate it if you would tell us, what is it, why is it that older persons are more susceptible to financial abuse? And when we say older persons, I mean, tell us, who are we talking about? At what age are you considering someone being an older person?
Well, in California, the law defines an older adult as somebody 65 and older. And actually, in the United States, that varies from state to state. But in California, it's somebody who's 65 and older. And just a little statistic to kick us off. Right now in the United States, 6,000 people every day turn 65. In 2011, when the baby boomers start having their 65th birthdays, it's going to be 10,000 people every day who have their 65th birthday, and that's going to continue for 20 years. So we are a rapidly aging population. To get to your question about why older adults are more vulnerable to financial elder abuse, I think it's really important and cannot be stressed enough that a lot of our older adults are isolated and they are lonely. People are outliving their social support systems. And unlike young children who have to go to school, older adults can kind of slip off the radar without a lot of people noticing. That's one important reason.
Are you talking about older adults who are living by themselves?
I am, yes. And actually in San Francisco, 40% of households with a resident 60 and older are single-person households. San Francisco actually has one of the highest proportions of older adults, and many of them live alone.
One more thing before I perhaps shift for a moment. Is there something, with your experience as a clinical psychologist, that happens with an older person's brain where they are not more suspicious? Let me put it this way. They're more trusting of someone who might look nice. Now I'm getting into the area of, you know, scams, this kind of stuff. Is that what's going on or what? I mean, you mentioned isolation and lonely, but I'm wondering if there's a change in the brain.
Yes. I think it's important to stress that, most older adults do not have dementia, although the older we get, the more of a risk factor that becomes, such that by the time we're 85 and older, 40 to 50% of us actually have a dementia. But long before that occurs, many older adults have changes in their cognition where they may become less able to manage their finances and to be alert to particular types of scams. People also get very medically frail, and people have periods of vulnerability. You may have a bad reaction to medication, you may be fighting an infection, and go through periods of confusion that are temporary.
I'd like you to talk about this because in my practice as a deputy DA for San Mateo County, I have on occasion had an older person who's been involved with perhaps some kind of scam, and my office has wanted to have adult protective services go out with the feedback I have gotten that the older adult is very suspicious of adult protective services. Is there some reason for that?
Well,
and if so, tell us what it is, or if there isn't, tell us what it is, please.
Well,
and by the way, Steve and Prescott, please chime in here if you like. But I think this is important because I've seen this with very significant financial abuse, and we have wanted to have someone helped by someone with adult protective services, and sometimes they do not want to have or to get any help.
Well, I think there's a number of reasons that an older adult might be wary of adult protective services. One thing is that alleged abusers or predators may threaten the older adult that adult protective services will try to take them to a nursing home, and that can be a big fear. A lot of older adults really strive hard to maintain their independence. It's also true that a lot of older adults feel that one mark of maintaining their independence is not having to talk to adult protective services or not having to let in any type of outside help.
Because they're proud.
Absolutely.
Is there some truth to adult protective services taking someone out of their home and putting them into a nursing home?
Absolutely not. Many people don't realize this, but adult protective services is actually, for the most part, a voluntary service. So, you know, the social worker will go and work with the person, and their goal really is to try to investigate reports of abuse and to put services in place that maintain an older person's independence as maximally as possible. Adult protective services does not have powers to pull a person out of their home and put them in a nursing home. You know, if somebody were very incapacitated and was being preyed upon, they would have to go through probably a probate proceeding
conservatorship.
Exactly.
All right. Well, let me, if I can, turn to you, Prescott, because you've been on the program several times now. And
thankfully.
And you've suggested topics, including this one. You work for an outfit which is very significant, California Advocates for Nursing Home Reform. How do you get so concerned about financial abuse of the elderly?
Well, first of all, where our organization interfaces with the predator is over the issues of long-term care and the seniors' two major fears. For us, seniors fear outliving their assets, and they fear going into an institution. Now, the government has a number of programs out there, specifically the Medi-Cal long-term care program, and it's at that point where seniors or family members who are looking to help seniors will go out and look into the community to get information about how do we qualify for Medi-Cal or what should we do, should we go into a nursing home. Now, it's the financial abuse that occurs doesn't always occur just because the elder has some form of cognitive impairment. These people who are involved with the financial abuse that we're seeing, these professional predators, what they are, they're very sophisticated, and they really operate using three techniques on the senior: fear, anger, and greed. That's the best way to explain it. What they'll do is they'll talk to the senior, and they'll convince the senior that they have, let's say, a 50% chance of going to the nursing home. Average stay is 2.5 years. This is not true. These are not true statements. And actually, if you look at the California information from OSHPD, which is the Office of Statewide Health Planning and Development, they track all the people that go into the nursing homes. Their numbers in, numbers out. And somebody 65 years of age or older, well, if they go into the nursing home, 70% will leave the nursing home. They'll be discharged by 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
By 1 year, it's down to about 12% of the seniors who go in will still be there. By 2 years, you're down to 6%. Mm-hmm. So if the senior hears they have a 50% chance of going to the nursing home, average stay is 2.5 years, that's the fear button. And then what they'll do is they'll get them going with anger. They'll say the government has a program, and that program is an entitlement program. It's just like your Medicare. It's just like your pension. This is something that belongs to you, and the government is not going to let you know about that. I will let you know about that. It's an entitlement. So fear, they get angry, and they go to greed. And Erica, the other day, I listened to a speech that she made. And in it, she had a wonderful definition of greed. Greed is entitlement plus opportunity. Mm-hmm. So the senior hears, you have this entitlement, and the opportunity is the person who's talking to you. And what they'll do is they'll get the individual to move all their assets into the product they're selling. Sometimes it's a senior service, such as I will qualify you, I will guarantee qualify you for Medi-Cal should you go in. Or more often than not, it's about an annuity, mm-hmm. a deferred annuity, which will take $100,000, take the life savings of an individual and lock them up into a product that they won't be able to touch for 10, 20, 30, sometimes 50 years.
How are the older persons coming in contact with these people who at least are trying to sell them the annuities? How does this generally happen?
Well, you know, it's like anything else. If you're looking for something, you'll find it. I mean, mm-hmm. going back in life, you know, you didn't notice children until you started having them. If you need a new car, suddenly you see new cars everywhere. If you're thinking about a nursing home, then suddenly you see in these flyers that are coming in through the mail, or you see at the senior centers indications of, well, there's going to be a seminar that's going to be offered. There's people out there actively looking for seniors, and if you want to find the predators, they're easy. Mm-hmm. They advertise. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the seniors are connecting, and that's where the predators are connecting with the seniors.
You, Steve, you have been involved in major litigation involving some of these cases of senior financial abuse or older person financial abuse. What do you want to let us know early in the program here?
Well, predators come in many different forms and take advantage of the opportunities that present themselves. So the kind of cases that we see often involve abusive annuity sales. We also see many opportunities that predators are availing of themselves of pre-qualification for Medi-Cal programs. So these things are widespread around the state, and we often see, for example, seniors who will pay $10,000, $15,000, $18,000 for a service that is billed as pre-qualification for Medi-Cal. These are absolutely scams that where the money is essentially paid for no service of value at all. There's been some recent legislation that has addressed this problem that we're hopeful will help in this fight against these kinds of predators. This legislation was a revision to a particular consumer protection law called the Consumer Legal Remedies Act. Mm-hmm. And it adds a new form, a new definition of unfair consumer practice, which is the charging of an exorbitant fee to help a person obtain public benefits. And one of the things that was written into this new statute is it not only defines it as an unfair consumer practice, but it also requires that the court award mandatory treble damages in these instances. Because one of the practical problems is that where an elder may be ripped off for $10,000 or $12,000, that's a lot of money for the elder to lose. On the other hand, $10,000 or $12,000 is not enough at stake for an attorney to get involved. It becomes too expensive for the attorney's time to pursue a loss of that kind. So the thinking behind this new statute is that by trebling the damages, perhaps we can interest more attorneys in taking these cases.
Now this is in effect right now?
This law went into effect January 1 of 2009.
And is it a state law or a federal law?
It's a state law.
It is a state law. Can you tell us under what code section it is? Do you have that at your hand?
Yes, it's in the civil code starting at section 1780.
I see. Okay. All right. That's good.
Another important advancement that has occurred. It's been a long time for years I was hearing attorneys wouldn't take cases because, you know, if the matter was $40,000, $50,000, $80,000, if at the end of the day the bad guy can't get rid of that much money, well, who are we talking about? So an attorney that has been approached by somebody that has been ripped off for a certain amount of money, well, they have to say, well, at the end of the day, at the end of the trial, will that money still be there? Can we get a judgment? Now, the law was changed. In fact, Steve Reese wrote the law. I won't be modest for him. It's an excellent advancement, and that advancement is this. At the very beginning of a trial, in law and motion, you can go to the judge, and the judge will freeze an asset, and that's the Attachment Act. And so now civil attorneys can get involved in these cases and find out early on, will there be a chance to get a recovery
for the seniors? What kind of an asset are you talking about? I mean, in the very beginning of a case, you may not know too much about the financial ability of the defendant. Tell us basically, how do you find this out, Steve, early in the case, where you can get a freeze on whatever the asset may be?
Well, the procedure is called a right to attach order. And at the beginning of the case, or actually at any time the case is pending, the plaintiff's lawyer can apply to the court for a right to attach order. And if the certain elements are demonstrated to the satisfaction of the judge, then the judge will order this attachment, and that allows the plaintiff's attorney to take the right to attach order and attempt to levy, is the legal term, against assets of the defendant. The ability to find out what assets that defendant has, of course, is somewhat limited. There are opportunities to do some forms of discovery. Sometimes you may have indications of where the assets are. But I think the principle that is really important here is you attempt to tie up the assets of the defendant at the beginning of the case rather than at the end of the case.
So when you get your judgment, assuming you do, you have something to go against.
That's correct.
Right. As opposed to just having a piece of paper that said you won whatever the amount was, which is very, very significant.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And it's a very now, this right to attach, is this part of the new law?
It's a separate statute, but it was enacted in 2007 and became effective January 1, 2008.
Very significant. Very significant. Let's do this. I want to ask you this. We need to, this is the statewide version of the program, the first half hour, which we send out to a number of stations in California. And if you're not in the Bay Area listening to us live, but are listening on the Internet, if you have radio on the Internet, we're on www.kalw.org for the whole hour. But however, the statewide version, the half hour, is recorded and we send it out. So what I want to try to cover here in this statewide version is, what are some of the things that people can be thinking about in terms of prevention of financial abuse? Whether you are an older person yourself, or whether you are the child or a neighbor or a relative of an older person, what are the kinds of things that you might want to talk about? Erica, please.
I wanted to make the point that, unfortunately, what we know about elder abuse of all kinds, and this isn't just about financial elder abuse, is that a lot of times the alleged abusers are family members. Our best estimates are that in something like 70 or 90% of cases, family members are the abusers. And it's also true in financial elder abuse. So as unpleasant as it is, I think it's important to really choose carefully if you're going to assign someone a durable power of attorney to make sure that that person, even if that's a family member, is reliable and is honorable, because unfortunately, all too often, we see children who are tired of waiting for their inheritance who find some way to advance it to themselves by having a parent sign over a deed or getting on accounts, and it's really painful.
Well, that's interesting, and the data's there to say that the numbers of instances are bigger amongst family members, friends, and caregivers, but the amount of damage that's done by far is much in excess when it's the financial predator, the institutional predator. A study came out from MetLife, and they showed that in this period they looked at, there was $13 million of financial abuse collectively by family members and caregivers.
13 how much?
$13
million. Million, okay.
In this period that they took a look at. In the same period, there was $232 million worth of financial abuse. A smaller amount of people, but the damage is huge. Mm-hmm. One of the problems that we're seeing is, you know, with certain seniors, it's a matter of reward repetition, and they get softened up, and they're susceptible to other kinds of financial abuse. The reverse mortgage market, for instance, is doing a wonderful job of getting their message out there that these are great products. They're great products, and in many instances, they are great products. However, the seniors are softened up to think, well, that's a good way to get money. The predators are taking advantage of the fine work that the marketers of reverse mortgages are doing and coming in and convincing the seniors to pull out equity to fund their products. We have many instances where people who are insurance agents who are selling these products that lock up the seniors' money for the rest of their lives, are getting the seniors to take out these very expensive loans that cost 6, 7, 8% compounded. And when you take 6% compound, $100,000 at 6% compounded over 10 years, the senior's going to owe back $181,000. And with that, they're purchasing an annuity that's only going to net out $21,000 for them. So it's going to cost them $81,000 to earn $21,000.
Oh, my.
So, you know, these are the kinds of things we're seeing. And then back to the family members, you know, if they know that the family has money, of course, with the equity in the home, if the senior's been softened up to think, well, that's a good way to get the money without realizing the high cost of the loans, then you're going to see a lot of damage coming in from these family members that are pulling out equity to take that for themselves.
This is probably a good jumping off point also to mention that there is a bill pending in the legislature this session to address specifically the problem that Prescott has described. That is the abusive sale of an annuity to an elder who has a reverse mortgage. And this is Assembly Bill 2066. It was authored by Assemblyman Dave Jones out of Sacramento. Yesterday, it moved out of the Judiciary Committee and will move on into the Insurance Committee next week, where it faces stiff opposition from the industry. But essentially, this bill attempts to remedy the problem of combining the sale of annuities with reverse mortgages. Mm-hmm. The basic idea being that a person would really only consider getting a reverse mortgage if they had inadequate liquidity. That is, they might have equity in their home, but they had inadequate cash and they needed the cash for something important, medical care.
Or being able to live on a month-to-month basis.
Being able to live, or medical care,
yes.
or home repairs and so on.
Yes.
But you would only consider getting a reverse mortgage if you lacked available cash.
Mm-hmm.
You really would only consider buying an annuity if you had excess liquidity. That is, you had money that was available that you were very confident you would not need for many, many
mm-hmm.
years.
Mm-hmm.
So to combine the two together, a reverse mortgage where you need liquidity and an annuity where you have excess liquidity makes no sense. And you end up paying the differential between them in terms of the amount that you earn on the annuity versus the amount that you pay for the money.
I just wanted to jump in and kind of talk quickly about family crimes, because I think, you know, we want to protect elders from all kinds of abuse. And one of the problems is that a lot of financial abuse that happens within families really is a silent crime. And it doesn't make the newspapers, which was the methodology in that MetLife.
Exactly,
right.
Yeah.
And so I do want to talk about what people can do actually to protect themselves. And there are a few simple things you can do. I think one of the most important things is to actually keep your estate planning documents, if you have them, up to date. And if you don't have them, get them.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing...
What do you mean by keep them? Where would they be if you didn't keep them?
Keep them up to date.
Keep them up to date. All
right.
Right.
So make sure that, you know, you're still wanting, you know, child X to, you know, be the person who's going to be in charge of making your financial and or medical decisions. So that's really important. The other thing is telemarketers and mail fraudsters have huge traction. Simple ways to screen them out. You can get on a do not call registry. A lot of older adults are really polite, answer the phone. If they're getting scammed by telemarketers, really easy to just get an inexpensive answering machine so they can actually screen their calls. Identity theft happens a lot when people put their outgoing mail in a mailbox. An easy way, an easy way around that
An unlocked mailbox,
Exactly. So, you know, have people, you know, not put their outgoing mail in an unlocked mailbox. You can also opt out of credit card offers. You can sign up to avoid junk mail. You can also get your credit report.
Free, yes.
Yeah, every 4 months if you rotate.
Through the rotate credit between the three major credit reporting agencies.
And I would say before you make any big financial move, the first thing you would do is don't do anything. Your first thing is
Don't do anything, what then do you do?
You go to the second, third, and fourth.
Okay.
You really study and you go to as many diverse sources to check it out.
Well, okay, give us some examples. We're nearly finished in the half hour, but what are the diverse sources you're talking about?
I go to three different professionals that do the same kind of thing that aren't connected with each other, and then go to other.
What kind of professionals would you go to?
Well, let's say if you're going to buy an insurance product, go to three different professionals, and then have them look to give you some kind of ideas. Is that a good idea? And show different things. Talk amongst your family members. Talk amongst other people. You know, families should start talking amongst themselves because we're all living a much longer period of time, and it's time for the older adults to have adult conversations with their adult children as well, because the family needs to come together along these great decisions that are going to happen, especially around long-term care decisions and how do you pay for that. This is very important for the elder to get as much information before they make a move.
Steve, would you have the last few words for the statewide version of the program? You wanted to say something.
Yeah, I just wanted to add in terms of being a discriminating purchaser, it's very important, particularly for an elder, to inquire how the person who may be pitching the particular product or service is getting paid. And very often they will go to great lengths to conceal how or how much they're getting paid. With annuities, for example, I've had multiple clients tell me that when they've inquired as to how the sales agent was getting paid, they would say, well, you don't pay me anything. And what the agent really meant is the check from the elder would be paid to the insurance company, and the insurance company then pays the agent. And so
what kind of percentage do these people get, these agents get?
Well,
generally speaking,
they vary greatly. They can be as low as 3% and they can be as high as 18 or 20%.
All right. It is about a minute and a half before 7:30. This is 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. It's also Your Legal Rights, and we are doing a live program. If you have a question, if you have a comment, you have a concern, you'd like to talk to my guests about it, please join us. The number is 1-415-841-4134. That's 1-415-841-4134. If you're out of the area and you're listening to us on the Internet, if you have radio on the Internet, and you've tuned in, www.klw.org, you can also call that number, 1-415-841-4134, with your question, your comment, your concern in this area. If you are concerned about some older person, maybe it's yourself or someone who you know, a friend, a relative, or whatever, please join us with your question, because if you have a question, you're probably one of many people who would have the same question. By the way, let me tell you who my guests are, and then I promised I would ask Prescott Cole what the Clay Award for Elder Law is, and that's what I'm going to do. Prescott Cole is Senior Staff Attorney with California Advocates for Nursing Home Reform. It's referred to as CANNER. It's in San Francisco. You received this year the Clay Award for Elder Law. What did you do to get that?
Well, I think actually it was a cumulative award, basically. I've been doing a lot of work in the world of financial elder abuse, and the organization I work for, Cantor, actually we started some 25 years ago, and with that we were looking at the issues of elders going into nursing homes, and we broadened from there to go statewide to look at not only nursing homes but assisted living. We get into how do you pay for nursing homes, and then that's where I ran into this financial abuse. Mm-hmm. For years, I've been going out trying to recruit attorneys and others into the world of financial elder abuse. In fact, I had the great pleasure of bringing Steve Reese into this.
I understand you both were in grammar school together.
It took me years to get him into financial
Oh, my God. You've been working on him since grammar school.
Finally listened to me one time. Anyway, so Steve came into it with a background where he had 28 years of litigating in a whole variety of areas, mm-hmm. from contract to injury cases, whatnot. And then when he got into to financial elder abuse, he brought in all that knowledge that he had. And from there, he went into legislation to plug up these holes and mm-hmm. to start boosting financial abuse. Now, specifically, I was recognized for the work that I did on behalf of Cantor with a piece of legislation that looks at financial abuse that comes in through reverse mortgages.
Okay. Well, I thank you for telling us that.
There's more to come.
No question. I know that. Stephen Reese is a financial elder abuse attorney in San Francisco. That's who Prescott was just talking about, and as Prescott said, has been very much involved with the legislature in drafting financial abuse of elder laws. My third guest is Dr. Erica Falk. She's Director of Geriatric Assessment and Psychological Services at the Institute on Aging in San Francisco. She is a clinical psychologist, and so I want to encourage you, if you have questions, comments, or whatever, to join us with your questions. We do have one here that was called in and brought into the studio here. I've attended one of those seminars where annuities are being offered, higher interest rates, tax-free, better than investing in mutual funds. How can one distinguish the genuine annuity programs from the scams?
Ouch.
How about you, Steve?
Well, the purchase of an annuity by an elder is often very problematic.
For those of us who are not that familiar with an annuity, what basically is it supposed to do? So at least we know what the basics are.
Right. Actually, the question you're asking is a very difficult question. It is quite difficult to explain very simply what an annuity is. In its most basic form, historically, that is what annuities were a generation or two ago, was a type of insurance that by which a person could insure themselves against outliving their money. So the idea is you would pay a lump sum, a principal sum, to an insurance company, and in exchange, they would agree to make periodic payments, monthly payments to you, as long as you lived. Mm-hmm. So that if you lived to be 110, they would continue making those payments. And of course, the rate that they pay is fixed, and they would calculate that on the basis of your actuarial life expectancy. That is how long they would expect you to live. If you outlive that life expectancy,
you're making a profit.
Then you have made a good investment, mm-hmm. and if you do not outlive your life expectancy, then the insurance company gets a windfall. But let me just reiterate, that is the historical, theoretical rendition of a annuity. That is not what we see annuities as today. They're far, far more complex than that. There is a type of annuity called an immediate annuity, which is similar to the one that I've just described. But for an elder to purchase an immediate annuity, that is to convert a principal sum into a stream of income for their life, also is very problematic. In order for that to be a good, sound investment for them, two very important things have to happen. One, the elder must outlive their actuarial life expectancy, and not just outlive it a little bit, mm-hmm. outlive it a lot, because built into the numbers are not only the profit of the insurance company, but its overhead as well, and the commission that they pay to the agent. So if you have a 12-year life expectancy and you buy an immediate annuity, you may have to outlive your life expectancy by a third in order for it to pay off, to reasonably pay off.
Another 4 years in your example.
Exactly. The other thing, the other condition to make it, even if you do outlive your actuarial life expectancy, the other condition that's very important for it to make sense is that you don't suffer some kind of an illness that causes a substantial spike in your monthly expenses. So, for example, if you've, in order for the immediate annuity to pay off, you have to outlive your actuarial life expectancy and sort of iconically get hit by a bus. That is, you die immediately without undergoing some long-term illness. Because what's not unusual for an elder is to become ill. They may be living in their home. They may have paid off the mortgage on their home or have reduced the debt on their home. The property taxes may be low. And they may be have a lifestyle that costs, for example, $1,500 to $2,000 a month. If they become ill, those expenses may spike up to $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 a month. Now, if you've had $100,000 and you've converted that into an immediate annuity, what you've done is you've taken the $100,000 and you've converted it into, let's say, an additional income stream of $600 a month. That $600 a month, although it goes on for your lifetime, does not serve you very well if your monthly expenses go up to $6,000 or $7,000. So you would have been better off if you had kept your $100,000 and kept it in reserve to pay off those expenses.
Yeah, another thing, the caller talked about this tax advantage. So it sounds like it was something like a deferred annuity. And the problem with those products are you take a sum of money and you lock it up for a number of years. I mean, these are products that
usually many years.
They're products that are designed for a young person that has a big income and a lot of money in the bank, and they can't spend their income, and the money they have in the bank is making interest, and they're getting taxed on it. So it makes sense for somebody to tie up their money for 30 or 40, 50 years when they're not working, and they take the money out. Then they're taxed at that time. We're seeing 80-year-olds buying 20-year deferred annuities. And the problem with that is when, as Steve says, something happens and there's a spike in your need. Well, I mean, Steve, you want to talk about some of the surrender penalties you've seen?
Well, one of the interesting problems with deferred annuities is it's a little bit akin to the problem that we saw with the subprime mortgage meltdown. As you're probably aware or maybe aware, there was a feature of the subprime mortgages called the yield spread premium. And essentially what that meant is that brokers who were selling these loans, these subprime loans, would get paid extra. They had a financial incentive for which was based upon the interest rate of the mortgage that they were selling. The higher the interest rate, that is, the worse for the borrower but the better for the lender, the more money the agent got. So there was a financial incentive to sell these poor performing loans. The same dynamic exists in deferred annuities. There is a direct relationship between the amount of the commission that is paid to an agent and the length and the amount of the surrender penalty that is charged to a person who buys an annuity and then has to surrender it. So, for example, if an agent is paid 12% commission on selling an annuity and the principal sum is $100,000, then the agent would immediately be paid $12,000 commission on that sale. If the elder a year or 2 years later has an emergency and needs to get at that money, the elder will seek the surrender of the annuity. But the insurance company has already paid out $12,000 right off the top. So they charge a commensurate penalty to give the money back. So the higher the commission that's paid, the higher the penalty for surrendering.
When you say that, but you're not saying another 12% as a penalty, or are you?
Absolutely.
You are.
And the penalty will exceed the amount of the commission. So, and typically the surrender penalty schedule, there's a schedule that steps down incrementally per year. So it might start off at 15%, and then the next year 14%, yeah, and 13%, and so on.
Your caller was wondering, is this a good thing to sit in?
Well, and I think you've explained it as not.
Well, yeah, no, yeah, yeah. And they're going to get the rude awakening is when they need their money and they need it in a hurry, they'll get just a fraction of it back.
Well, I think you've made your point. This is something, if you're interested in an annuity and you're an older person, you want to be really, really, really careful. Let me just do this, and then we'll get to another question that someone has called in. By the way, you're awfully quiet out there. I don't know what you're doing or why you're not calling us, or maybe you're just too young to appreciate what we're talking about. And if you're too young, maybe your parents are someone or some persons that you should be concerned about. If you have any questions on financial abuse of the elderly, the number is 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. This is Your Legal Rights. We have a new time now, as you might know. We start at 7 o'clock, go till 8, and then your call comes on at 8 o'clock. It's repeated on a daily basis, Monday through Thursday. And let me also mention this to you. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. This is a public service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. And for a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. This information is brought to you by the Bar Association of San Francisco and KLW listeners like you. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own at 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county in California, every county has a Bar Association and lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone experienced in the area and set you up for a half an hour consultation with an attorney, usually in the attorney's office. Depending on the county you're in, it could be a low of $25 or maybe a high of $35 for half an hour. It's a great way to find out about your basic rights or obligations in the area that you're having a problem with. All right. And by the way, I want to let you know our next Call a Lawyer night is next week. That's Wednesday, April 21st, starting at 7 o'clock. We'll have a number of attorneys here who you can talk to off the air. If you want to write down the number, whether you listen to the program live or delayed, it's 1-800-525-9917. And we're going to start with Ellen. Ellen, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. This is sort of complicated, and I need to make it simple.
Please do, yes, if you would.
Several years ago, my brother, who lives near my mother, who has Alzheimer's, got her to change her will and give him and him alone financial and medical powers of attorney, I guess it is.
And, without your knowledge.
Apparently without her knowledge,
I had been urging my mother to fill out those forms, but she would always go, oh, that's upsetting me, I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
So he had her fill out the forms, making him the only one, and then he had her change her will.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my parents were always into dividing things evenly, and my father left most of the estate in an estate, you know, protected, but my mom had a certain amount, and my brother got her to give him a significant chunk, which I know is something she wouldn't have done, except she has Alzheimer's. So, I was visiting about a year and a half ago and discovered that he was having my mother write checks to pay off all his credit cards, many of his personal expenses and things like that, and it was a significant amount of money. And then he had her declared incompetent, and when I confronted him with this information, he went and took it all away and hid it, and of course I legally have no access to it. And he's constantly urging my mother's caretakers to spend less and less.
Julie, let me stop you at this point. Is your mother still alive?
Yes.
And where is your mother located?
In Southern California.
And you're up here in the Bay Area?
Correct.
And
this is why I thought my brother would be trustworthy, but he's not.
But he's not.
He's taking
not.
Advantage of her money. I know he is.
And you were, by the changing of the will, were you eliminated from the will?
I was not eliminated.
But your share was reduced markedly, I presume.
Yes, yes. Okay. But the other thing I'm concerned with is that he's using her money
for his own stuff.
For his family reducing what is spent on her, including telling her caretakers not to take her to doctors.
Okay, let me get some comments for you, Julie. Obviously, this is a long story.
The easy thing is, I just want to know what I should do,
okay.
Who I should consult.
All right, and you have not consulted an attorney about this at all?
No, I really don't have any money.
You have not consulted Adult Protective Services, at least up here?
No, I have not.
Okay, well, let me get some comments.
I talked to the lawyer who is in charge of her estate, but they just brushed it off as sibling rivalry.
And where is the lawyer who is handling her estate? Down in Southern California?
Southern California,
okay,
also.
Let me get some comments for you. Turn your radio back up, will you?
Okay.
Please, so you can hear what my guests have to say. All right, this is a very difficult problem that probably is repeated a lot, I suspect. Erica, what comments do you have for Julie? I mean for Ellen.
Yep. First of all, Ellen, it sounds like a horrible problem. And unfortunately, I hear this kind of thing over and over and over again. And I'm very sorry. My first recommendation to you would be to call Adult Protective Services in Southern California in the jurisdiction where your mother lives. And you can find that by calling each county has an area agency on aging, and they will have that number for you to call. You can explain things, and they will have local resources there that they can either refer you to, or they may conduct an investigation themselves. That's my first recommendation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then I would suggest that Ellen might want to contact the lawyer referral service, the county bar down in Los Angeles.
Down in L.A.
To get an attorney that does contested conservatorships, because where this thing would be heading.
Yeah. Ellen, good luck to you on this, but certainly please follow through on contacting the Area Agency on Aging down in Southern California. I can't remember if you made it more specific than that, but try to do it with the county in which your mother is located. Julie, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. Yeah, my question is about identity theft. Mm-hmm. I recently had an experience. I have no idea whether it would result in that or not.
You are the victim?
If there is a victim,
okay.
It would be me.
Right.
But I don't know whether it was just a scare or real or whatever.
Yeah.
And I don't know what people are supposed to do about it. I know that you could call the credit bureaus.
Well, tell us what happened. Why do you think you're a victim of identity theft? Julie, without going into a long, long story, try to abbreviate it, would you?
I went to an insurance company that was offering a good rate on an investment product at a better rate than usual, and the way they paid the difference is they give you a check for the difference between the rate that a CD pays and what they're offering.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left, the more I thought about it, the company seemed like a sham. It seemed like a virtual office. I could have shopped a better rate than they did. There were just things that made me nervous. Now, the only thing that happened that I realized I did something stupid is they call the bank, you buy the CD from the bank, but they're sitting there listening to all your personal information. So if they are crooked or a scam, I've just given them all my identifying information.
I mean, wait a minute. You did this personally or on the phone?
I went to their office, they called the bank.
They called the bank, and you gave all of this information
to the bank, which I didn't think anything of, because banks need that information to establish that kind of an account. But here was the person listening to it.
When did you do this, Julie?
About a week ago.
Okay, and do you now have a product? Did you actually invest in a product?
Well, no, because the following morning I decided, wait a minute, this doesn't feel right.
You saw, as you had your nightmare that night, you saw red flags waving.
I saw red flags. I went to my bank in the morning and froze my account.
Good. I'm glad you did. Did you give your Social Security number?
Yes, everything.
Oh, boy. All right. What you may want to do is very soon get a credit report from each of the three credit reporting agencies,
The problem is that if they don't use it for 3 weeks or a month or 2 months, what do? I can't keep doing that.
Well, that's true. You can't keep doing it for free. But, Erica, you have some thoughts on this, do you not?
Let me ask you one other thing before you go on to that.
Sure.
I don't know what the protections are. Like, I alerted my credit card companies and so forth, and I know I'm protected on that.
Yes.
What I'm not protected against that I know of is if they just go and open some credit line or go buy a car or something in my name. What kind of protection does a person have?
All right. We'll get some comments for you, Julie.
Thanks.
Go ahead. Start, if you would, Erica.
Sure. Unfortunately, I think you are in a position of needing to be vigilant. And so you can get a free credit report every 4 months, and you do that by rotating through the three credit agencies. That's one thing you can do.
I say also, generally, for other listeners out there, if you're a senior and you purchase an annuity, you have a 30-day grace period, and you can give back the annuity and break the contract within that that time frame.
But she's talking about she's given all of her financial information. And she thinks the people in the office where she went may be using this for nefarious purposes.
Right.
Well, I think her...
Go ahead, Julie.
I think your instincts...
They do have the licenses that they purported to have. They are licensed.
They do have that. Okay. And by the way, Julie, let me ask you this. Have you checked with What city are you in?
Oakland.
Okay. And so... And the outfit that you went to, is it located in Oakland also?
San Francisco.
In SF. Have you checked with the Better Business Bureau to see what kind of a... history this outfit may have?
Not yet.
You should.
They had a Better Business Bureau sign up there, but it expired in January. So that was one of the things that made me pause when I went home.
Okay. I suggest tomorrow that you call the Better Business Bureau, the Golden Gate BBB, and ask them. And by the way, you can. Do you have a computer?
Yes.
You're on the internet?
Yes.
You know, you can access that through the internet.
Okay, I'll check that.
And see what kind of a record this outfit has.
Right. But Stephen, is there any protection that people have against someone else fraudulently opening up a credit account?
Well, the protection, if you find out about it and you know who it is, you go to the police and report it. However, at that point, it may be that something has happened. Well, one of the things in ID theft is that in the statistics that I'm aware of, that sometimes people don't find out about this for something like 18 months.
That's what I'm worried about.
Yeah. And so you've got to be vigilant with contacting the credit reporting agencies, the three credit reporting agencies. And Stephen Reese wanted to respond. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment, Julie, that I think your instincts were correct in going to your bank and freezing your account. Mm-hmm. And you didn't describe what specific, you know, the types of specific information you gave them besides your social security number and bank account.
Credit card number.
Right.
No credit card number.
Oh, you didn't.
All the personal identifying numbers that a bank needs to open a CD.
Right. Oh, okay. Well, I mean, you depending on the information you gave them, you might may want to go to the trouble of closing the account and opening a new account, perhaps even at a different bank. On the other hand, I don't want to give you any false assurances, but there is on the other side of the scale, if they have a physical location, a storefront or such, or an office, and they are licensed, and you find out that they've been there for a while and been in business, they may not be in business stealing people's identification.
Yeah. Yes, I'm hoping that's correct.
Julie, who are they licensed by? What agency?
The California Department of Insurance.
Yeah, well, you can call the California Department of Insurance also and inquire about what kind of a record they have.
Oh,
sure,
okay.
Of course.
Okay.
So you got some homework to do, but, you know, also with regard to the credit reporting agencies, I presume you know that you can get a free credit report.
I also know that they can put a freeze on things, but then I wouldn't be able to use my credit. I've heard horror stories like that, so I would not want to do it if there are other options. I just didn't know if there's any protection. Like, if somebody steals my credit card and they use it, I'm protected against that.
Julie, I've heard that you can place a fraud alert with the credit bureau.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and then they freeze it every time you try to go to the grocery store. You get embarrassed and they don't take your card. That's why I'm not anxious to do it.
No. That's a different thing. Freezing is different from having a fraud alert. So you need to contact the credit reporting agencies and get the specific information from them. Yeah, good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, we've got Linda. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And
of course.
The woman who just made the comment about the credit alerts and also the difference between that and a credit freeze was what I was going to say. So I had to go through that myself.
Did you? Okay, you did a credit alert.
Yeah, you can get a credit alert.
Which did not freeze your account.
Right.
Okay, yeah, so there is a distinction, but if it's a credit alert, as I understand it, what it is, if there is something strange about this, they will communicate to you. The credit reporting agency will communicate to you that there is something strange going on. Is that how you understand it?
Yes, if someone tries to open an account, they will check with you first before going ahead, letting it go ahead.
So that's what Julie should do.
I think so.
Okay. Anything else, Linda?
That's it.
Good. And were you ripped off?
I was a victim of identity theft, but fortunately, some smart person in a store caught the mistake. I caught the fraud, and so.
Well, you know, one of the things that happened to me, I've been a deputy DA for a number of years, and I used to swim with someone at the Y in Redwood City, and this man had just retired. He opened up an account at a major bank. Lot of money, and he got a call one day from someone down at Downey Savings in Southern California saying, Mr. So-and-so, did you write a check for $25,000 to this person? And he had just opened the account. He hadn't even received his checks. And he said, no, I didn't. They held the check. They held the check. So you got to be careful. It was obviously an inside job. So good for you that you didn't get hurt, and thanks for calling on that.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you for the show.
Oh, sure. My pleasure. All right, let's do this. We have about 3 minutes left. Do you have, Erica, do you have 30 seconds of final comments for us?
Yes. If you have aging parents, have conversations with them early about how there's going to be some oversight over their finances as they age. Even if they're incredibly capable, there are ways of supporting independence by making plans and, you know, kindly looking over their shoulder. Also, don't hesitate to call Adult Protective Services.
Stephen, please.
I would say the old maxim of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure is doubly true in this area. I would caution anyone, but particularly elders, to be very cautious about entering into transactions that they do not understand. And even if they feel like they understand them, they should take their time, they should do their due diligence, they should investigate the transaction, and they should discuss it with trusted advisors.
And one of the basic things is don't trust anyone too soon. Huh?
Exactly.
Okay. Prescott, last words.
Okay, thanks. I would say that the most important thing is if you're dealing with a professional, they're the professional. You're not. You'll never be able to outthink them. You don't know what they're really doing. And be very, very cautious, because the mistake that you make when you're an elder with your finances, basically it's the last mistake you'll ever make.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Prescott Cole, Senior Staff Attorney with California Advocates for Nursing Home Reform. Erica Falk, Director of Geriatric Assessment and Psychological Services at the Institute on Aging in San Francisco. And Stephen Reese, Financial Elder Abuse Attorney in San Francisco. Thank you very much for joining us. By the way, I want to let you know we're doing our Call a Lawyer next week. We're going to have a number of attorneys here, so if you want to join us at 7 o'clock, 7 p.m., whether you listen to the program live or delayed, if you find out about this, we are doing our next Call a Lawyer on April 21st at 7 p.m., and you can call 1-800-525-9917 on the air. We're going to be talking about what happens if there's a death during a marriage dissolution proceeding. So we're going to be talking about family law as well as estate planning law. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association and the San Mateo County Bar Association. Be careful out there, all of you, whether you are an elder person or younger person, just don't trust too many people, or maybe sometimes anyone. Thanks for joining us. I'm Chuck Vinny.
One point seven KALW San Francisco.